Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Episode 70. I can't believe we've done 70 of these things now. I know. Extraordinary, isn't it? Time does fly. So often with this podcast, we will pick a handful of topical subjects and talk about those. I think you sort of have to do that when you record a podcast every week. But just as often, we like to pick one topic and go deep on that one topic for 40 minutes or something. This week we've chosen Bentley. Now, I was thinking a lot about Bentley yesterday evening and what that brand, that mark, means to me. And I realised that actually it doesn't resonate with me anything like Aston Martin does, because I prefer more inherently sporting cars, which Aston Martins tend to be. I also think there have been more beautiful Aston Martins. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of it. I think you're right. I would put the case for Bentley. I don't know whether I think Bentley does resonate more. I mean, I have a particular connection to Bentley because my father was obsessed with them. So I'm probably not an objective observer, but I think what you're right that they have not. They're not as sporting as Aston Martins. They have historically not been as beautiful, or a lot of them have not been as beautiful as Aston Martins. But what I do love about them is they have a strength, an engineering integrity to them. And really, I think it's one of the things I most admire about the company today, is that they still, even today, appear to be going beyond what's strictly required to get the job done. And I just love that, because that was absolutely the ethos. We're going to talk about WN in a minute, I think. You know, that's been the way the company has been since the start. And even when it was taken over by Rolls-Royce, you know, Rolls-Royce was another company which had this this reputation for engineering excellence. And I just love that. I just love cars that you get into them and you just feel that they have been put together by people to whom their craft really matters. It's not just people doing it. God, people are sending, you know, washing machines and refrigerators. That these cars, and it's a different kind of passion. It's not as easily identified as that which you can find in a car because of the way that it looks or the way that it gets down a road. But to me, it's still really, really important. And I think that so long as Bentleys have that, they'll always find people who buy into that. I certainly do.
Okay, well, Bentley is a good topic to choose for this podcast, because I could do all the research I like and I'll still never unearth more background, more anecdotes, more interesting facts than you will just have stored up in your head. So why is it that you know so much about Bentley? Why does the mark sort of mean something to you? You mentioned your father.
Yeah, I mean, he was just obsessed with them. I mean, he was absolutely, completely, and utterly, and not not modern Bentleys, old Bentleys, pre-war Bentleys. I'm not sure why it was that he just settled on those things. I think he just admired, they were so usable. I mean, he had one, which my brother still has to this day. And he did, I mean, he did insane things. I mean, he did the Mille Miglia in it. He drove it across America. He drove it around South Africa. He just loved the fact that you could get in these cars, which were, you know, even then, whatever, 60, 70 years old, press a button. And you'd have all the sense of occasion and all the magnificence and all the feels and the smell of a car that was from that era. And yet you could just use it and abuse it, and they just never let you down. And I think I've always had this thing about a car is only as much fun as it will allow you to have, depending on how often you get to drive it. And it's the sort of car that you could just drive all the time. I've got a mate who's got one. And there actually aren't many places he hasn't driven it. He drove it from Peking to Paris. He's driven it across America. He's driven it down through South America. I mean, he's just been... and all these adventures, as far as I'm aware, the only problems he's had has been punctures. And this is a 1929 car. And that was...
So they were just that over-engineered. They were that tough.
Yeah.
And was the attitude to hell with the weight of it?
Well, I mean... Yes, because I don't think they appreciated the import. But also, you know, remember that he wasn't building... So if we're talking about, the racing cars, he wasn't talking about Grand Prix cars then. You're talking about cars which, you know, had to survive a 24-hour race. That's what, you know, the Bentleys were most famous for doing. You know, there's also the fact that they didn't understand things like metallurgy and metal fatigue the way we do today. And so the only way that you could be sure that something was going to last was to, you know, was to overdo it. But also, W.O. Bentley was an engineer who was just obsessed with doing things to the highest possible quality. There is, for instance, you know, one of his cars went off and did a 24 hours around Le Mans in the 1920s. And the strip down report, they took the engine to bits and they measured everything after 24 hours of racing. And the stripped-down report reads, in its entirety, nothing to report. And they put it back together again and stuck it back in the car.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so yeah. That's what I really, really buy into. He wasn't an inventor. There wasn't anything that he'd done which had never been done before. But he did take stuff, which was at the time pretty innovative stuff, and just do it better than anybody else had ever done it. And my father, I think, really bought into that. And just growing up in that, I mean, he was a very, my father was a very characterful guy. And it was very hard not to listen when he was banging on about this stuff. And so I just, you know, while everybody else was, I don't know, listening to the charts, that sort of thing, I would just, you know, as a kid, I'd just be reading stories of Bentleys at Le Mans. And I became, you know, really pretty sad on the subject. And aged eight, I could tell you every driver who raced every Bentley at every Le Mans from the first one in 1923 to when they stopped doing it in 1930. I probably still could.
Well, we might quiz you on that later on. Okay, well, we really have to start with Walter Owen Bentley. Now, I've been doing some reading up, and I'm just going to sort of recite some of it now. You leap in if anything's wrong, okay? Born in 1888, he raced motorcycles and cars as a young man, and he was an engine designer, aircraft and car engines. I read this yesterday, and it actually rang a bell. I did know it. I'd read it before, but I was still surprised to be reminded that he went to Clifton College between 1902 and 1905, which is 800 metres behind me. It's there. I can almost see it. I think he must be Clifton College's most famous alumni. I think that's cool.
I don't know. Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah, and so he clearly born into a prosperous family. And he founded this company called Bentley in London, Bentley Motors Limited in London in 1919.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we've spoken a bit about him and his background and what his sort of engineering philosophy was.
Yeah, I mean, just before we actually get onto the company, I mean, his World War One record, I mean, what he did was, you know, World War One was a pretty perilous time to be flying aircraft, as you can, not just because, you know, you were being shot at, but also because, you know, these aircraft were more than capable of killing you all by themselves. And they had very, very unreliable engines. And WO decided that that was intolerable and that far too many lives were being lost that way. And so he designed two engines. One was called the BR1, BR for Bentley Rotary. And they really made, the other was a BR2, and that came in right at the end of the war, not really enough time to make a huge difference. But they really, really, I mean, they went into sort of things like Sopwith camels and, you know, all these things that we've heard of. And pilots stopped dying because their engines kept working. And I think that that part of his life is probably not appreciated in the way that it should be, because frankly, it was clearly far more important than anything he ever went on to do in the automotive sphere. So I just thought I would just get that in. And then, yeah, you're absolutely right. He came out of the war. His wife died, a Spanish flu, but he kept on and he founded his own company in 1919 in New Street Mews in London. And there's this lovely story about the first ever engine, first ever Bentley engine, sitting on a bench in New Street Mews. And they fired it up and it had no exhaust on it. So, I mean, you can imagine the racket. And a nurse at a nursing home next door came running and absolutely livid and told them that she was looking after a man who was dying. And they turned around and they said to him, well, that sounds to die to go. They ain't going to get any better than that. And that's certainly the story. And yeah, and then Bentley Motors began.
It was a stroke of fortune, actually, thinking about it now, that he founded this company in 1919 with a certain set of ideals. And then literally a few years later, started this race in the north of France called the Grand Prix of Endurance that gave his company the perfect platform to demonstrate speed and durability, the things that Bentley stood for.
Yeah, but he thought Le Mans was a ridiculous idea.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he said, it's a crazy race. Cars aren't designed to race for 24 hours. Nobody will finish. So the first ever Le Mans was in 1923. And the only foreign entrant was one Bentley, but it wasn't Bentley's Bentley. It was a bloke called John Duff, decided he was going to go and do this completely bonkers race. And WO was just said, well, this is just ridiculous. There's just no point. It'll never make it. But Duff said, well, I'm going anyway. And at the last minute, WO, I'm more out of kind of curiosity and I think a bit of a sense of guilt, got on the boat and toddled over and said he'd man the pit for as long as this car lasted. And the car not only lasted, it would have won the race had the roads were in such a terrible condition. And basically, they were almost racing on gravel. And they hadn't bothered to protect the fuel tank. And a stone went through the tank. And the car got stranded out on the circuit. And so I think Duff was driving it and he ran to the pits. And then Frank Clement, his teammate, get this, got on a bicycle, cycled up the track the wrong way with the cars coming the other way. Can you imagine that today? Someone getting on a bicycle and driving around Le Mans the wrong way while the race is going on. Repaired the tank with some chewing gum, had some fuel from somewhere, got it in the car, got the car going, got back to the pits where they repaired it properly. They then broke the lap record, and I think they came fifth in the end. But I don't think there's any question if that hadn't happened, they'd have won the race. At which day, and from that moment on, WO was just completely obsessed with the place and just thought, wow, this is incredible.
It does seem to be the case, doesn't it? He must have loved it from that first year, having been sceptical, because in 1924, Bentley went and won it.
Yeah, but even that wasn't Bentley's Bentley. That was like an M Sport operation. That was a private car, but it was totally prepared by Bentley and run by Bentley and everything else. And then after that, they were proper works entries.
Yeah, and then we're into the proper Bentley boys era, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
The late 20s.
But they won it in 24, yeah. And didn't in 25 and 26, and then won it every year from 27 to 30.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And okay, so let's talk about some of the characters then, the Bentley boys. Who stands out? Someone like Tim Birkin?
Birkin was an amazing bloke, very small in stature. That's why they called his actual name was Henry, but he was Sir Henry Birkin, but they called him Tim out of Tiny Tim because he was a little bloke, but he was brave as life. You have to remember these guys that very few of them expected to be alive. They'd all just come out of the First World War. lots of them had been, one of the guys, a chap called Bernard Rubin, who won Le Mans in 1928. I think he'd spent 2 years in hospital, the injuries he'd received on the Western Front being so bad. And, you know, they'd all had pretty terrible wartime experiences. And they were all looking, for them, every day was a bonus because they didn't expect to be alive. And B, they were looking for a way of just putting some meaning into their lives and having some excitement. And, you know, racing cars around places like Le Mans 24 hours was very much the place to do it. So Birkin, he was the bravest of the Bentley drivers. He was the quickest of the Bentley drivers. I wouldn't say he was the best, because far too often, even the way that WO built cars, Birkin found a way of breaking them. He would just thrash them and thrash them and thrash them. He was absolutely merciless. But he did break the Brooklands lap record in 1932, driving his famous single-seater red car at 139 miles an hour. And he died the following year. Bentley went bust in 1931, so he was already, you know, and also Birkin was the man who did the blowers. I don't know if we're going to talk about the blowers, but this was, you know, Birkin wanted to make a Bentley go faster. And Bentley's very traditional purist way was that you want to make it faster and you need more power. What you do is you make a bigger engine. And Birkin said, well, we haven't got time to do that. And it's just one, you just bolt a supercharger on the thing. And WO hated it. He said, you know, to supercharge a Bentley is to pervert its design and corrupt its performance. Hated it. But Birkin had private money. He had the backing of Wolf Bonato, who by then was the chairman of Bentley. And so these cars were created. And the legend of the blower was started. And Birkin was absolutely the person who was behind that. And, you know, we all love blowers today. And Bentley themselves, they've just gone and created another 12 of their own number two team cars. The inconvenient truth is that a blower never won a race. You know, Bentley's won loads and loads and loads of races. None of them was won by a blower because almost always they just broke because they were doing something to a Bentley, which a Bentley was not designed to do. And that was all Birkin. And then tragically, because there weren't Bentleys to race anymore, because Bentleys had stopped and gone bankrupt and so on, he won Le Mans in 1931 in an Alfa Romeo with Earl Howe, which is great. His second win in the race. And then 1933, he burnt his arm on the exhaust pipe of his Maserati in the Tripoli Grand Prix. Got septicemia, and because back then, you know, there weren't, you know, antibiotics or anything else like that, tragically, he died at a very, very young age. But yeah, bit of a dude.
Wow. What a life story. What about Wolf Bonato? Do we need to set aside a bit of time for him? He seemed like a bit of a character himself.
Yeah, well, he was a diamond millionaire. His father, Barney Bonato, was one of the richest men in the world. And so Wolf Bonato, his Le Mans record is I don't believe that anybody will ever... I mean, Tom Christensen, fair play, won Le Mans 9 times. Amazing. But he had a few attempts. Wolf Bonato only won Le Mans 3 times, but then he only did Le Mans 3 times. Played three.
That is
three.
Exceptional.
Not bad, is it? 28, 29, 30.
Crikey.
Yeah, he won every Le Mans he ever entered. And WO always said that Bonato was the best driver that they had. They were all amateurs, apart from one. There was Frank Clement, who drove in every Le Mans Bentley did from 1923 to 1930. He was a professional racing driver, and he was really, really good. But he was just solid and dependable, whereas Bonato was fast and utterly dependable as well. But he was, I mean, he was a remarkable man. He was, I often forget, the list of things that he did is so long. He was a powerboat racer. He was a boxer. He had racehorses. He kept wicket for Surrey. He was obviously an incredible racing driver. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, he was just a consummate overachiever. An amazing man. And the sad thing about Bentley Motors and WO's story is, however good an engineer WO was, he was as bad a businessman. And it's not at all sure. I think that there was 1 year 1929, in the history of Bentley Motors, where they made a profit. I think they ran the business at a loss every single year. And by 1925, it was absolutely on its knees, and it was going to the wall, and that's when Bonato came in. And basically, W had to give up control of his company. And by the end of the era, 1930, I mean, WO was pretty much sidelined. He was doing some of the engineering, but the last ever vintage Bentley, the 4-litre, didn't even have a Bentley engine in it. Because the crash had come 1931, and they had these massive, wonderful 8-litre Bentleys, which nobody wanted. And they just thought, shit, we've got to get something which is affordable and doesn't use ridiculous amounts of fuel in it. And so they literally went to Ricardo, the same Ricardo who builds McLaren engines for them to this day, and just said, we need an engine. And Ricardo had a six-cylinder, 4-litre engine, which was, you know, a decent enough engine, actually. But they put it in this enormous 8-litre chassis, so it couldn't get over its weight. It was so slow, and it actually hastened the end. But, you know, at the end, by then, you know, W was a completely marginalised figure. Glenn Kidston, we just need to talk about him briefly. He was just another one of these characters. He was shipwrecked. He was in a submarine that sank and survived that. He was shipwrecked again. He was in an aircraft. He was the only survivor of an aircraft that crashed. And he survived because he literally beat his way out of the side of the aeroplane. Of the flaming wreck. And he was the only person to get out of that. He won Le Mans with Bonato in 1930. And then died, I think the following year. Because he'd just broken the record from flying from London to Cape Town. And I think he was in a Tiger Moth. And he was just flying around South Africa somewhere, and something happened. The engine stopped, and that was the end of him. So
bloody hell! The story of Bentley, the early story of Bentley, is full of remarkable characters, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Often meeting very unfortunate ends.
They had George Duller. He was a championship jockey there. I mean, just all sorts of. Sammy Davies, who was the technical editor of Autocar. Amazing cast of characters, all with this devil-may-care attitude to life. And you could see why, to a sort of, you know, eight-year-old me, I just found these people incredible. I just found these people, these guys were my absolute idols, because the lives they led were so exciting and so exotic. Frankly, so different to the one I thought I was going to have. So, amazing people. I mean, I think that's why that era is so alive for Bentley. I think it's as much about the people who were doing it as the cars they were doing it in, to be honest.
It really is comic book stuff, sort of boys' own adventures, isn't it? I totally understand why that caught your imagination as a kid. That's the very early years of Bentley. And we'll move on to the sort of later periods shortly. But I just need to do our now customary app update. As ever, you know, we try to publish a real variety of stuff on the app, stuff that you just won't find in other car magazines, on other car websites. For instance, we've got our in-house car engineer, David Tuig, who's an enormously experienced engineer. And he's written the first part of a two-parter called A Car Design Odyssey, explaining just why it takes 3, 4, 5 years to go from the original concept for a car, not even the concept, but the original idea for a car, to the start of production. And he also sort of calls out a lot of these startups who claim that they got from point A to point B in 18 months or 24 months, because it's just not possible, according to our in-house engineer, David Tuig. And the second part of that story will be up very soon. So that's on there now. We've also had Andrew's been knocking about in a fuel cell car. It sounds like you were quite taken by this thing, actually.
As a form of transport, yeah. To me, this is increasingly the way I see the world, is that cars divide into transport and things you want to drive. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for a car to be both. So there will be, you know, there will be the things that we knock about in for work, and then there will be our recreational toys. But yeah, the fuel cell car, I mean, I was just very taken by
Toyota Mirai,
that it has genuinely, it's not, this isn't claimed, it's actually claimed to have a range of over 400 miles, but it will genuinely do 350 miles. between fills. And then when you fill it, it takes 4 minutes. Now, the problem is you've got to find somewhere to sell hydrogen, which is not the matter of the moment. And I'm not saying that this will be the future. What I am suggesting is that it should, even if it won't be, it should at least be part of the future. Because for people who do distances, I don't care that you don't get very much power out of, I mean, Mirai's got 180 horsepower. You know, Tesla, the same money, all have 450 horsepower or whatever. Doesn't trouble me because, as I've said before on this podcast, I don't find the way electric cars deliver their power to be particularly interesting or particularly appealing. But I do like, I like the range, I like the recharging. And also there just seemed to be a certain sophistication in the way it wasn't this sort of all or nothing, meat or two veg type of approach that you get with electric cars and the way that the power is dispensed. So, yeah, I liked it. And I know they're not as efficient as electric cars. And they say, oh, yeah, but, you know, think of all the losses. But if all the energy that you're losing through those inefficiencies is sustainably gained and is made from renewables, I'm not sure that's such a big issue anymore. Anyway, that's enough of me on fuel cells. But it was really, really interesting.
Mm, yeah, it's an interesting sort of thoughtful piece. I've also written about my car. Yes, I do own an Alpine A110. Thank you, everyone, for pointing that out.
Who knew?
And it's, I won't say any more about that. And there's also a piece by Andrew about the Lotus Esprit, specifically Colin Chapman's last ever company car, a turbo, that you got to knock about in a little while ago. A very special car, that one, actually, with a great story.
It's a great story. It's a very special car. You read the story, you'll see what modifications Chapman had put on the car. But I think, you know, to me, it's a rather sort of poignant story because it came at a time in his life. He wasn't going to live very much longer. But, you know, the road car business was in a terrible state. His revolutionary, game-changing Lotus 88 Formula One car just being slung out. And, you know, at the back of his mind, the whole DeLorean thing would have been brewing, which was, you know, clearly going to land him in a whole world of pain. I mean, his working life must have been intolerable. And so, you know, set against that background, to go and have a go in his last company car, it's still only done 11,000 miles. Where I was like, Lotus had just bought the car back. It having been away from the company for nearly 40 years. And I was the first person to drive it after they'd sort of fired it up and made sure the wheels were pointing in the right direction. They hadn't done anything to it. So I was literally driving, you know, everything about that car apart from the paint was original. So it really was, you know, it wasn't a trigger's broom. This was Colin Chapman's car. So it was, it was a special thing to do. But they are going to go through it, make sure that everything is working absolutely properly, and then I'm going to go back and have a proper go in it.
Oh, fantastic. So all that is on the app right now. Just go and search the Intercooler on whichever app store you use. You'll find it there. And you can start your free trial for a month. We think you'll like it. Right, let's get back to Bentley. Okay, we're moving into the Rolls-Royce era. And yeah. Actually, it was a slightly cloak and dagger thing, wasn't it, that Rolls-Royce took control of Bentley.
They nicked it.
In the early 30s. Okay, go on. Let's have the story.
Well, Bentley was always going to be, I'm sure many people listening to this would have heard of Napier. I mean, Napier was a very proper company. They made aero engines, they'd made some cars. They'd been out of the car business for a bit, but they wanted to get back into it. And Bentley was just the perfect, you know, thing that they could just, you know, one step solution, take it and be back it. And the deal was done. Everything was absolutely fine. And it just needed to be rubber stamped in a court. And somebody stood up and went, we've got a counter offer. And it literally went to, and I can't remember the name of the company that this bloke was from.
I might have it. I don't think I do have it. But it was something sort of vague, wasn't it? Intentionally vague.
Yes, exactly. It was, you know, I don't know, Northern Chartered Tiddlywinks or whatever. And so this bloke stood up and said, well, we'll give you more. At which stage Napier went, oh, well, we'll pay more. At which stage the judge literally said, I'm a judge, I'm not a bloody auctioneer. so put your final bids in an envelope and whoever's higher gets the company. And this mystery man bid much more than Napier did. And it was actually this, and so this strange company got Bentley, and everybody knew that this blip was clearly representing someone, but didn't know who. And it was actually WO's wife was at a cocktail party where, let's get this right, she met someone who'd overheard a bloke called Arthur Sidgreaves, who worked for Rolls-Royce, saying that they'd just bought Bentley. So WO found out that his company had been sold to Rolls-Royce from his wife. And that was that. So that was 1931. And really, the slightly sad thing about it was that Henry Royce, who was still alive at the time, didn't even really want Bentley. The only reason he bought it was to stop anybody else getting it. He didn't want Bentley to be a rival. He didn't particularly want it himself. He and WO didn't particularly get on. Royce was an old and dying man by then. I think he died in 1933. And so it was all a bit fraught. WO went to work for the new company, and he did do a bit of development, and he did like the first of the Rolls Bentleys, did admire it. But he spent most of his time sort of doing development, driving and cruising around the place in these cars. He wasn't really instrumental in the car's design at all.
So the sort of shell company, if you like, that Rolls-Royce invented in order to pinch Bentley was the British Central Equitable Trust.
There you go.
Which gives nothing away, does it? okay, so now we're well into the Rolls-Royce era. I have to say, they're so entwined for the next few decades, I sort of get a bit lost. But what's at the heart of it? Is it mostly badge engineering of a sort?
There's nothing really to get lost in. I mean, Bentley. The silent sports cars, up until the war, the silent sports cars were completely different. Okay, they used developments of Rolls-Royce engines, but they were highly tuned, and the cars looked completely differently, and they were tuned to be very trivial. And those pre-war Bentleys, Derby Bentleys, as they're called, are very, very underrated cars. Those who know, know. And particularly the very early cars, which are quite light, and the very late cars, which had overdrive gearboxes and better steering and so on, they're terrific things. But then after the war, with the odd exception, really the big exception being the R-Type Continental, which was this incredible, the fastest four-seat car in the world in 1951. But that was the exception to the war. You know, with the exception that Bentleys essentially ceased to exist, they just became, you know, Rolls-Royces with Bentley badges on them. You know, by the end, so Bentley got its identity back in the 1980s. So by the end of the 1970s, you know, they had, if you bought a Bentley T2, which was a Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow, it had a different radiator grille, which actually meant it, therefore, because of the shape of the top of the grille radiator, it had to have a different bonnet, and it had different wheel centres and different badges. That was it. Even the handbook didn't say Bentley. If you look at the handbook, and it said that it was a Rolls-Royce handbook. You open the bonnet on the engine, on the cam cover, it'd say Rolls-Royce. So, Bentley ceased to exist. Bentley production by the end was 4%. So out of every 100 cars they made, 96 would be Rolls-Royces.
Oh, wow. Mm. God, that is interesting. So it was almost dormant through that period.
Yeah, well, it became worse and worse and worse. The Bentley brand was steadily eroded over a period of, well, I suppose we start in, you know, when production started again after the war in 1946, up until the end of the 1970s.
That's interesting. And so the sort of final third of the last century, it was, we could call it the Vickers era. How did things change for Bentley between sort of 70 and 98, when Vickers owned the thing?
Well, what happened was someone had the idea of trying to make something out of Bentley again. And they thought, well, what does Bentley represent? It represents power and speed. Well, what do we have? We have a Silver Spirit with this unbelievably lazy... They were so ashamed at how little power that 6¾ litre engine had, they didn't even tell anyone. Literally, every time anybody asked, they would just say, adequate. It probably didn't have 200 horsepower, 6¾ litre V8. It was so lazy. It was so understressed. And so someone stuck a turbocharger on it. And the Bentley Mulsanne Turbo was created. And immediately it started getting people's attention. And then they made the Turbo R, the R standing for road holding. because this was because the Mulsanne Turbo was basically, it was just a Silver Spirit with a turbo engine in it, but they did realize fairly shortly that actually it wouldn't be a bad idea if this thing went round corners too. And then suddenly it was meteoric. Suddenly Rolls-Royce was passé. Rolls-Royce was fuddy-duddy. You could have the quality of a Rolls-Royce in a car that was actually pretty cool. Went like smoke. And these things always do build on themselves, because suddenly Bentley was making money, which meant there was some money to spend on Bentley, and they started doing these other cars, things like, you know, the Continental R and the amazing Continental T. And it completely, by the time Volkswagen stepped in 1998, in those, whatever it was, much less than 20 short years, the tables are totally turned, and Rolls-Royce production was almost exactly at the same proportion that Bentley production had been at the end of the 1970s. And by then there was, you know, the Arnage was out, and it was problematic because Vickers didn't invest in the brands. I don't know whether they didn't have the money, or they didn't have the expertise, or they didn't have the interest. And so although Bentley did dominate the Rolls-Bentley landscape by that stage, the cars they were putting out, I mean, sales were, you know, they were making 1,000 cars a year. And that's, you know, that's not a sustainable business, really. And the cars were trading too much on brute speed and sort of old world charm, and not enough on actually being, you know, any good at what they did. So Vickers lost interest. The company was put up for sale. There was, you know, a horrible fight between Volkswagen and BMW, both of whom wanted it. And in the end, Volkswagen got the company. It got Bentley. It got everything. The only thing that BMW got didn't get Rolls-Royce. It got the right to call a car a Rolls-Royce. Because the name, the Rolls-Royce name, belongs not to BMW, but to Rolls-Royce PLC, the aero engine company. So in 1971, Rolls-Royce cars and Rolls-Royce aero engines had split up, which had needed to happen because the company was bankrupt because of the development charges of the RB211, which is the big thing, big engine you see hanging off the wings of 747s. And so they'd gone their separate way, and thereafter after, the aero engine company had licensed the name for Rolls-Royce to use. And to this day, Rolls-Royce PLC gives Rolls-Royce in Goodwood permission to use its name on their cars. So that's all BMW bought, was the right to call a car a Rolls-Royce. It didn't buy any product at all. And so Volkswagen got Bentley in 1998, and the modern era of the company began.
So we're into the VW era, and it's the era that I'm much more familiar with. I remember, when was this? So it must have been 2001, 2002, seeing spy shots of this new coupe called the Continental T.
How old were you in 2001?
15. Turned 15 that year. Why? Why do you ask? Anyway.
No, keep going.
Yeah, so I remember seeing this sort of camo clad coupe thing with four round headlights in the pages of Auto Car magazine, thinking, wow, this is really cool. And it was the first time I'd sort of clocked onto a new Bentley. Yeah. And sort of been quite excited by it. The Continental GT came out in 2003, didn't it?
Just before we get on to that, can I ask you, because I'm really interested in your perspective, as a sort of whatever you would have been, 15-year-old lad, Bentley going back to Le Mans for the first time in whatever it was, 71 years. Did that even register with you? Was it important to you? Did you know about Bentley in the 1920s and all its stuff? Or was it just, you know, another headline in autosport?
Good question. I remember a very big magazine feature in a mag that didn't last very long. It was called Zero, a very beautiful mag that came along for a short while. And I remember seeing the Speed 8 in there. I think they They'd spent some time with a team at Le Mans 1 year. And so I read up about that. But actually, I didn't know about the heritage, really. Didn't understand the significance of Bentley going back to Le Mans. But you're quite right. Before we move on to the modern Bentleys, we need to talk about that return to Le Mans.
Yeah.
And you're very familiar with it, weren't you? You spent some time with the team during that period.
I was there pretty much for... I mean, I was writing a book about it, or I'd been commissioned to write a book about it. So, you know, I went to a load of the tests. I was at Le Mans for, you know, a fortnight each year. I was the idiot who would stand in the pits and, you know, when... You know, I can remember Dindo Capello in 2003... He did a quadruple stint in the night, in the Speed 8. And he came in and his eyes were pointing in different directions. I mean, he was absolutely spent. And I had to go and interview him for the press release that was going to get put out. And it was a pretty difficult job, actually, because none of these guys understandably wanted to, they just wanted to go and, you know, calm down, get a massage, have a drink, get some sleep. The last thing they wanted was some twat with a microphone asking them, oh, how was it for you? Anyway, so, but it was great.
Those cars were, they were actually just Audi R8s, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. You know how to wind me up, don't you?
You get very wound up when people say that, don't you?
Well, only because it's not true, and you know, and because this myth has been somehow perpetuated. Yes, okay. It was designed so they did two speed eights, one which raced in 2001, 2002, and then the one which won the race in 2003, which was a completely different car. But they were all designed by the bloke who designed the Audi R8, okay? And they had Audi engines in it, and they were done at a place called Race Technology Norfolk, which is where the Audi R8C, this other Audi, which Peter Ellery, the designer, had done, had been done. And so people just said, oh, well, you know, it's an R8 with a roof on it, because the R8 was winning everything. It absolutely, categorically, absolutely, pantolutely was not an R8, with or without a roof. They used to say, Bentley used to say, that the R8 has got more British content on it than the Bentley has German content in it. I don't know whether that's true or not. But anyway, so, yeah, they did this program. It was a three-year program. The best year was 2001, the first year, because they're absolutely... Because I was there, I know all this stuff. And because Richard Lloyd, the late, great Richard Lloyd, who ran the team in the first 2 years, you know, he and I were quite close. And, you know, and he said to me, if we get one car home in the top 10, that'll be a real result. And in fact, they put a car on the podium. And that was the emotion in the pits that day. When the car went over the line, and then when they brought the trophy back into the tent, you know, I can feel myself getting emotional just thinking about it now. Bloody hell, it was 20 years ago. Anyway, and I was there in 2003 when they won it. And in 2003, when they won it, everybody was really happy. Everyone was really proud. It was a job well done. But in 2001, when they had... But frankly, if they hadn't won it in 2003, because there wasn't a Works Audi there that year, it would have been shocking. They were far and away. 2001, you know, that was a largely wet race. They'd never run the car in the wet because they just hadn't had any wet weather during the entire fest. You know, Dunlop, which was coming back to endurance racing, you know, they had no data at all with which to create their wet tyres. I mean, it was such an impossible task. And to put a car on the podium, it was, and to witness what happened when it did it, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in all the years I've been doing this job. Far more remarkable than the winning it in 2003.
Mm. Oh, wow. And those Speed 8s were gorgeous cars, weren't they?
Yeah.
They looked sensational.
I may be driving one quite soon.
Oh, my goodness me. Right, well, you're going to have to tell us about that then.
Well,
no, you're a lucky sod, aren't you?
I am lucky. Well, no. Do you know what? I'm not going to jinx it. I'm not going to jinx it because something will happen and, you know, they'll get someone who actually, you know, has a right to be in it. If I drive it, okay, I'll come back on the podcast and tell you about it. Okay, so I'm not saying another bloody word about it.
Okay. Okay, good. All right. Well, we're sort of running over as it is, but let's just do a couple of minutes then on the current lineup or the more modern stuff.
Yeah.
The Continental GT had a broad appeal, didn't it, among a certain sort of buyer. And it sold relatively for Bentley in big numbers, and it really turned around
most
the company's fortunes.
The most important Bentley in the history of the company, with the possible exception of the very first one. You know, Bentley, as I was saying, before the Continental GT was selling about 1,000 cars a year. The Continental GT comes in 2004, really. By 2007, the year before the financial collapse, with the Flying Spur, which was basically a four-door Continental GT, they were selling 10,000 cars a year.
They were
selling so many cars, they had to start building Flying Spurs in Dresden. The only Bentley is not built by Bentley, ever. Because they just couldn't keep up with the demand for the things. And if you think about, if you take something like, an Arnage, the last car that came before, they were incredibly expensive. They cost, even back then, £170,000. They weren't that powerful. And along comes the Continental GT. It had 552 horsepower. Bog standard car. Not a speed or anything else, which isn't an awful lot less than they get than they have today. And this was in 2004. And it cost, I think it was £104,000. I mean, it was not only far and away the fastest Bentley that had ever been produced. In real terms, it was also far and away the cheapest. And that was an absolutely mind-boggling proposition. A 12-cylinder, 6-litre, twin-turbo, four-wheel drive Bentley for two-thirds of the money that you could buy any other Bentley for. I mean, it was just extraordinary, and it totally transformed the business. And that is the defining car in the modern history of Bentley.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I've spent quite a lot of time in them. They're brilliant cars. However, I think the all-new one that replaced it a couple of years ago, for me, it's an altogether better car.
It is.
I think it's much sharper to drive.
Yeah. That's the other thing. The original Conti GT, if I whisper it, it wasn't that great a car. I mean, it was a good car, beautifully engineered car. Ride wasn't great. Handling wasn't great. Engine didn't make a wonderful noise. It was quite a flawed car. Today's Continental GT, proper. Mm.
It's exceptional, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Really is.
And you'd have yours with 8 cylinders?
Yeah, defo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? Okay, you lose a tiny bit of performance, but it's a bit lighter. It sounds so much better. It's cheaper.
And it feels so quick, the V8 one. It really romps along.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Bentley is now a 10,000 unit a year company.
Yeah.
So it's significant. Half of those, roughly, sadly, are SUVs, the Bentayga. That's what people want, I suppose. I suppose we should just round out this podcast by discussing Bentley's future. What lies in wait? I mean, we know that they're going to have to go all electric quite soon.
They've said that by 2030, they are going to be end-to-end carbon neutral.
Pwah, that's impressive, isn't it?
They want to be the world's, what do they say? The world's most sustainable luxury car company that there is. It's really, really interesting. I mean, I think they're brave committing to what they've done as early as they've done it. I think it's sad that, those wonderful thundering Bentley engines aren't going to be doing their thing anymore, but I don't suppose you can blame Bentley for that. I do think that, in theory at least, electric is probably good powertrain for a Bentley. I think it'll suit Bentley a lot more than it does many other manufacturers because, it's all about torque. It's all about refinement. It's all about, easy access to power. So I think that an electric Bentley can still be a Bentley and feel like a Bentley. I think the great gamble is that by 2030 or whenever they start doing these things, that range and recharging just isn't an issue anymore, because people aren't just people spending that kind of money on a Bentley, they're just not going to want to spend hours standing at some scuzzy service station. They're just not going to want to. They're going to want to get in their cars and go. They want to be able to drive their cars from London to the Alps with one stop taking no more than half an hour. And they'll just want to blitz it. And that's what a Bentley will have to be able to do by then. And, you know, good luck to them. I think it's quite a challenge.
Yeah, the technology's going to have to come some way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, final thing I want to say is that, you know, even in this VW era, where, with platform sharing and all the rest of it, when you go to crew and look around the factory, you still see skilled craftspeople doing their thing. Rows and rows of workers on sewing machines, very, very skilled. The way they handle and treat their wood veneers, all that sort of stuff. There's still people using their hands to build these cars beautifully. And even when they're powered by the most modern electric drivetrains, there'll still be people who have learned a craft over many years and who really care building these things in the same old way. That's encouraging, I think.
It is. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think what's interesting, I think the challenge for Bentley at the moment is they've actually got a very narrow, in terms of price, range. You know, all their cars are kind of in the 150 to 200,000. Now that the Mulsanne, the wonderful, lovely Mulsanne, one of my favourite cars, has gone, not replaced. You know, I can't think of another luxury car manufacturer where the gap between its flagship and entry level model is as narrow as at Bentley. And I think that's a really real challenge for them. I think they've got to find a way of broadening it. And they'll probably do that at the top end because, frankly, that's where the volume, that's where the money is. But it'll be interesting to see what they do because, you know, they are missing tricks there. And I know that they know it, and I'm sure they'll address it. But to me, that's kind of what I find most interesting about the more immediate future about that is how they find a way of, you know, of producing Bentleys for whatever it is, you know, 250, 350, 450, just so that they can, you know, because they don't want to sacrifice that territory to anywhere else. I mean, at the moment, you know, Rolls-Royce now that Lagonda isn't going to happen for a long time, now that Bentley doesn't have a Mulsanne anymore, I mean, Rolls-Royce is just sitting pretty. They've got that territory entirely to themselves. And the longer that happens, I think the more difficult it's going to be for anyone to go and park their tanks on Rolls-Royce's lawn again. So hopefully Bentley will do something about that.
Yeah, and the Bentley brand stretches up to that price point very comfortably, doesn't it?
You should do, absolutely. We've massively overrun.
There we go. Well, I told you, Andrew knew a thing or two about Bentley. Good, we'll leave that on there. Thank you all for listening. Just remember to go and download the podcast. Go and download the Intercooler app. Your free trial.
Listen to the podcast. Download the app.
Download the app. Something like that. Do those two things and you'll keep us very happy. And we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.